Blog Talk Radio.
General's quarters. Security condition 3.
GQ, security 3, sir. General quarters 3, intruder alert. GQ 3, intruder alert.
Well, you know what that means. Welcome once again to Madame Perry's Salon, the podcast, some say, with more celebrities than the inauguration. And I am your host and cruise director, Madame Perry, or you can call me Jennifer Perry, or in England, J-Mod. But I'm just happy to have you here. So first of all, I have to thank you once again, because everyone that has been listening to the podcast and subscribing and downloading and sharing with your friends, you've really honored me, because you've made the numbers go up, which enables me to keep it going, to get sponsors on some nights, and to continue to get great guests like we've been having all year and like we have coming up soon. And we have tonight, of course. But it's thanks to you. I met a woman last week who told me she had heard about my podcast about 6 months ago, and now she says she's caught up, except for the last three. She started back at the beginning and began listening to everyone to get caught up in order, and I was just overwhelmed. So that's nice. Thank you. You know, and remember, you can always download for free, subscribe for free, and download for free here on Blog Talk Radio, iTunes, Apple iTunes, Stitcher, Blueberry, and probably a few other places that I don't even know about. Because I find more every day. I think there's one called Pod Fanatic. You can download it for free on there. Whatever you use to listen to podcasts or to subscribe, so you can check them out when you have time. Last night's guest was Ricky Bird, and if you listen, you know he's a Hall of Famer, Rock and Roll Hall of Famer, which he joined that institution or was made a member when he was touring with Joan Jett and the Blackhearts. He was a guitar player. And he also played with Ian Hunter from Mott the Hoople and just about every other famous person you know of. But he has been sober for over 30 years, and he has a foundation called Clean Getaway, which is the name of his newest CD, and it's very inspiring. So go to his website, cleangetaway.nyc, and it's a great CD. His voice is on point. The music is great. I was concerned that an entire CD with the theme of recovery, alcohol and drug abuse and recovery would just get monotonous. However, this guy keeps it interesting. Every song is fresh, like some rock, some Americana, some blues. He even takes you to church on a couple of songs. Very, very good. And the more you buy from him, the more he can afford to give to some of the treatment facilities that he visits. Also, last week, don't forget, Doug Stinson was on here last week. His book is called Downstairs at the White House, and it was written about... This is one of the funniest shows we've had. Doug Stinson was writing about when he was 17 years old, accidentally got a job as an intern, or got an internship in the White House, and this was during the Nixon administration, which gave him a ringside seat to Watergate. And as he told us stories about walking out of a conversation with Jim Brown, because he thought Jim Brown, about mistaking Pat Nixon, whom he says is a very nice lady, but mistaking Pat Nixon for a maid in the White House one evening, accidentally serving Coke to the chairman of PepsiCo. Yeah, he's got a lot of good stories, but at the same time, witnessing all these things up. So that's been an extremely popular episode, so check that book out as well. And tonight even more so. You know, if you're, it's hard to keep up sometimes. Our demographic of listeners here tends to go back and forth a bit. And sometimes if I have some younger singer or author, it might skew a bit younger. But most we stay in the middle between 35 and 65 years old. And a lot of people, I know, especially my friends, we grew up watching Star Trek and reading science fiction. I was such a big science fiction fan. I read everything, Ray Bradbury and Robert A. Heinlein, Isaac Asimov. I just couldn't get enough in Star Trek. And, you know, when I was growing up, we thought that by now, and I think Todd Rundgren even has a song about this, that by now we thought we'd have a house on Mars, we thought we'd have a flying car, and Rosie the Robot, like on the Jetsons, would be doing our housework. And we really thought, we really, really believed that this is what the future would be for us at this time. Not quite there yet, and yet more has been discovered than we think, yet there's still more to be found. My guest tonight, he's the news director at Alabama Public Radio and the author of Trailblazing Mars, NASA's Next Giant Leap, and also Final Countdown, NASA and the End of the Space Shuttle Program. He's known globally for covering 103 NASA space shuttle missions, the Challenger and Columbia shuttle accidents, and the construction of the International Space Station. He's spent over 14 years covering NASA for NPR, 8 for the USA Radio Network. He's an award-winning journalist and very fascinating, man. I am delighted to bring in here to the Genie Bottle. Genie Bottle, I guess that's also a callback to the space program. Pat Duggins. Pat, welcome to Madame Perry's Salon.
Oh, thank you, Jennifer. It's great to be with you.
Well, I'm glad. Come on and sit down. I don't know if you heard, but, you know, back in the very beginning of Madame Perry's Salon, someone said that it reported that it looked like the inside of Genie's bottle. So that's when people will come in and just, you know, some people that have been here more than once have their own cushion to sit on. And I was thinking, yeah, the Genie's bottle of I Dream of Genie, that's also a callback to an early show about the space program.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, there's a restaurant there that the actors would talk about, like, oh, let's go to Bernard's Surf, you know, and the actors would then go off to Bernard's Surf. Well, when I was covering the space program for NPR, there actually is a Bernard's Surf in Cocoa Beach, and it's a popular haunt. And in addition to having, restaurant fare and a bar and all that sort of stuff, on the wall they would have sketches by cosmonaut Alexei Leonov, the first man to do a spacewalk, and he later commanded the Apollo Soyuz mission, where we would link one of our Apollo moon capsules with a Soyuz craft from Russia. So it was a popular place to go. We certainly enjoyed it, and I guess, you know, Larry Hagman and Barbara Eden did during I Dream of Jeannie. So there you go.
And yeah, you know, we're going to think about it, start back to talking about Mars. And I know you also mentioned, you also bring this up actually, the beginning of your book, Trailblazing Mars, is our first, or, you know, people's first, I guess, impressions or fascinations or fantasies or ideals about Mars and about space. There were some of the Martian Chronicles, Ray Bradbury, mm-hmm. and War of the Worlds. From that all the way up to My Favorite Martian, do you think we were just exploring a fantasy and seeing what we wanted to see or what we were hoping was out there?
Well, actually, it goes back even further than that because, like, you know, my wife's father was he was an English teacher in Boston. And, when he passed on, we inherited many of his books, and that included some original first editions by Edgar Rice Burroughs. If you ever saw the movie John Carter, it didn't work out so well, although Jason Momoa may, you know, he may get more work as Aquaman, you know, but anyway, those were the same man who wrote Tarzan. I mean, you know, Me, Tarzan, You, Jane, also wrote about John Carter, who apparently was a gentleman farmer or something like that in Virginia, and somehow he wished himself upon the planet Mars, which the inhabitants called Barsoom, and there's all this kind of, you know, adventures going on there, and beautiful princesses and evil, you know, evil guys and all this sort of stuff, and flying machines and stuff. Well, that got NASA into trouble during its earliest exploration of Mars, because they, back in the 60s, they were sending spacecraft to go off. They were robotic spacecraft, no people on them. And they were, checking out what was going on Mars. And the thing about it was, all of these people apparently had read Edgar Rice Burroughs too, because they were expecting, you know, lush vegetation and exotic princesses and, you know, evil bad guys. I think one was named Mattai Shang or something like that. And when the Mariner spacecraft got to Mars, it was dead as a doornail. I mean, mean, people were actually talking about cutting off the space program because it didn't live up to the books that we read or our grandparents read when they were kids, you know, Edgar Rice Burroughs and stuff.
That's not what it's supposed to look like. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's all dusty and gross. I mean, wait a minute.
Yeah, that's, wait a minute. Somebody made a wrong turn. This is not right. So, yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah.
So, and then it went on to some more lighthearted things with Ray Walston as my favorite Martian.
Mm-hmm.
With Ray Walston and Bill Bixby, who was just Ray Walston was just a Martian that just kind of, well, he had landed accidentally and couldn't get his back and all the adventures he had on Earth. And then there's what? Marvin the Martian.
Oh my God. You're making me very angry. Yeah, I had a coworker back in Florida who loved Marvin so much. I mean, she would wear the shirts. She would have, like, decals of him all over her motorcycle. Just a huge fan. And when NASA sent its first two rovers to Mars, those two rovers were just known as MER-A and MER-B. It was like, you know, Mars Exploration Rover A and B. And everybody's like, man, that's really boring. You know, what do we do? And then I guess somebody who was a little bit maybe too young to have read Edgar Rice Burroughs, but they were old enough to be able to appreciate, you know, Marvin the Martian and Duck Dodgers in the 23rd and a half century. They came up with these. It was competing embroidered patches. One team from, I don't even know how it worked out, but it was like one of the rovers was like Duck Dodgers, and there was Daffy Duck on the embroidered crew patch that all of those people who were controlling that particular rover as it was making its way to Mars, they would have Daffy Duck. And the other group, they would be the lucky ones with Marvin the Martian. And that's sort of, you know, kind of the way it went, you know, in terms of, you know, what the rovers were called until they physically landed. And then there was a young lady, actually, I believe she was like an orphan from Lithuania or something like that, and she entered a contest to finally give the two rovers their names, which was Spirit and Opportunity. But for those of us in the press who had followed it, you know, from the very beginning, I still have the T-shirts. I still have the patches with Marvin the Martian and Duck Dodgers on it. So for us, it's kind of like, okay, we'll let the little girl, you know, have her fun with Spirit and Opportunity. But as far as we're concerned, I mean, it's those classic Looney Tunes characters. That's kind of what lit our candle.
and by the way, folks, and there are pictures of these embroidered patches in Pat's book, Trailblazing Mars. So I like how you had them put right there. So, oh, okay. And they look good, very official.
Oh, I had to go to the Jet Propulsion Laboratory because those were limited edition patches. And I said, hey, listen, I need to photograph them for the book because, you know, I'm a radio guy, and even though we're moving into, you know, the world of videos and photographs for radio stories now with the internet and social media, it was still kind of new to me when I was, you know, working on these two books. Oh, I have to have illustrations as well. And you couldn't find those embroidered patches with Daffy Duck and Marvin the Martian anywhere. I mean, I even went on eBay. I did everything. Turns out the Jet Propulsion Laboratory had them, but they treated them like the crown jewel. So it's kind of like, okay, we'll send you a couple just so that you can photograph them. But afterwards, if you don't, we're going to come after you and beat you with our pocket protectors or whatever they're going to do. But, yeah, so we got the photos, and nobody got hurt, and my publisher was happy, and there you go.
I'll bet. I'm surprised they didn't have you blindfolded and taken someplace secret to be able to photograph and then blindfold you again and lead you out. I don't know. I'd
have done it because it's like one of those, you know, it's one of those nostalgia things that I grew up with. I really wanted to include in the book. And getting back to my favorite Martian, I mean, you know, just north of I'm currently living in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, but just to the northeast of us is Birmingham. And when we visit our family there, there's this little bitty vintage toy store that has like the old fashioned model kits that you used to put together, like little plastic ones. You put them together, like, you know, three pieces, and it's done. And they had the original spaceship from My Favorite Martian. So instantly, I'm absolutely just, you know, enthralled with nostalgia because I grew up with that program myself way before I started covering the space program professionally. So it was a neat show, a neat bit of nostalgia, and they just don't make TV shows like that anymore.
No, honestly, they don't. It was just, you know, of course, It's hard trying to remember things like the things that they put in there, like what a woman got. There was a woman, a friend of the nephew played by Bill Bixby, who had a crush on Uncle Martin. So she makes him these desserts and cakes, and he can't touch them because they're polyunsaturated fat and it'll poison him.
Yes, I remember that one. Oh my gosh.
You do?
Oh, I do. And it's interesting because, like, you know, covering this, because I first started covering the space program, back when the Challenger accident occurred back in 1986. No one was covering shuttle launches at that time, journalistically, because it was like, you know, a plane leaving, you know, Birmingham Regional Airport. I mean, like, you know, they go up, they come down, they go up, they go down. And all of a sudden, one blows up. And nobody's there, so I'm the first one to grab a set of news car keys and a recorder and hop in our station's news car. It was this rickety old Toyota Tercel, and I'm like maybe 30 miles away from the Kennedy Space Center at that point, and I literally follow the mushroom cloud out to the Cape as that first shuttle disaster is taking place. The parts are still coming down when I got there, but once NASA got flying again and everything was, you know, getting back to normal, you'd get all kinds of, you know, hangers-on and celebrities that would just kind of like show up because the shuttle was really considered to be a really great show. And one of them, getting back to, you know, 1960s sci-fi, was, if you remember Lost in Space, June Lockhart shows up. I mean, Maureen Robinson, the mother of the Robinson, you know, family, and Dr. Smith and the robot. So she's there, you know, talking about, you know, just following the space program and everything. And at one point I bumped into Jacques Cousteau, who was there. He was there with the invitation of one of the astronauts because they were going to be doing some scans from space of the Earth's oceans. And earlier you made a comment about, you know, the reference about, oh, we'd be on the surface of planet Mars by now. Had a nice talk at a shuttle launch with Arthur C. Clarke, the fellow that wrote 2001: A Space Odyssey, you know, with HAL the computer and everything.
Yeah,
and he absolutely bemoaned the fact that, you know, by the year 2000, we were like 2002, 2003 when I met him, and he said, oh, man, by now it's like, you know, all these kids think, you know, we'd be doing Star Trek and warp drive and we'd be living on Alpha Centauri and stuff like that. And we were just – we had not even really finished the International Space Station by that point. I mean, we had some parts up, but even that's not going. So even going back to the moon was just, you know, so far away from what reality was in terms of the space program. And you know, Mr. Clarke was pretty bummed out about it, but, you know, we may eventually get there, but it'll be baby steps.
Mm-hmm. Well, then to take us up to your first book is Final Countdown, NASA and the End of the Space Shuttle Program, and then your more recent one is Trailblazing Mars, NASA's Next Giant Leap. And Mars, you know, has come back into the conversation a lot more in the last, well, probably the last, 5 to 10 years. But let's try to start with where we first began interested in the space program, and I get the feeling it was a little bit of we weren't as into it until we thought that the Russians might get ahead of us. And then
Oh, absolutely. In fact, it's interesting now because, you know, when you talk to what are the driving forces of us going to Mars? Well, right now it's Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos. I mean, the head of Tesla and the head of Amazon. And they, you know, they're billionaires. They may actually be able to do it. But as you say, back in the day, it was all Cold War politics between us and the Russians. In fact, here's a bit of trivia for you. There's a school of thought out there that if President Kennedy had not been tragically assassinated in 1963, we may not have landed on the moon for two reasons. Number one, the money, you know, landing on the moon after Kennedy's death basically became his retirement gold watch. In other words, we've got to do this one for JFK because he, you know, he made the speech at Rice University, we choose to go to the moon in this decade and all that sort of stuff. Okay, so there's that. But also, at one point, as I understand, JFK was actually thinking about abandoning the moon idea himself and just working with the Russians on some kind of a joint space station because he was afraid that the cost would balloon, which it did under Project Apollo after he was assassinated. So it's just kind of funny how things work out. But back in the day, I mean, the Russians and Nikita Khrushchev wanted to, you know, he's taking his shoe and pounding it on the podium. We will bury you, Americans, blah, blah, blah. And the Russians wanted to do everything first, and that included launching stuff into space. So they launched Sputnik, which, you know, I believe that was like 1957, I believe, when that went up. And even people who were working for NASA at the time would go outside and tune their radios, and they would hear the ominous beep, beep, beep from this Russian satellite as it passed over Washington, as it passed over New York, as it passed over L.A. and San Francisco. And Americans were just terrified. This is like, oh, my gosh, you know, science fiction stuff, you know, death rays from Mars and stuff. And then when we finally started launching human beings, the Russians, you know, they wanted to go ahead and be first, and so they launched Yuri Gagarin. Who? Well, that's a story in and of itself. Because if you're flying any kind of an aircraft, you don't get a credit for setting any kind of a speed record unless you actually land physically inside the craft that you're in. And Gagarin did not do that. He became the first human being to be in orbit, but he ejected from his capsule just before it touched down because the folks in Moscow weren't sure he was going to survive if he stayed inside. So they didn't tell anybody about that until years and years and years later. So there was a lot of cloak and dagger, a lot of trying to one-upsmanship, that sort of thing. There were people in Congress who said after the Apollo 8 mission, where they took the great picture of the moon rise over the moon, they were saying, "Hey, we beat the Russians to the moon. Let's go ahead and just cancel Project Apollo and forget about letting Neil Armstrong walk on the moon." So there was politics aplenty going on at that time, and it sort of made things interesting, I guess, on one side, but for NASA on the other, probably pretty frustrating because they just wanted to do science.
Mm-hmm. By the way, if you're listening to us live tonight and you want to talk with Pat Duggins, the number is 646-716-9922. That's 646-716-9922. And I think we got a call coming in here right now from the West Coast. Good evening and welcome to Madam Perry Salon.
Hi, it's Jennifer Irwin.
Hi, Jennifer Irwin. Oh, Pat Duggins. This is author Jennifer Irwin. And my client. And yeah,
good to meet you. How are you?
I'm going to be talking to you tonight.
I'm good.
We were just in Birmingham.
Yeah, my roommate in boarding school, her father used to head up NASA Space Center, and her brother was an extravehicular specialist and went on multiple missions.
Wow. Do you recall the specific name?
His name was David Lowe, and I remember watching Good Morning America when I was working in New York City, and they were singing to him at the space shuttle when he was out. But I have all the patches from the different missions he went on.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
In fact, one time my wife was, my wife kind of puts up with the fact that I covered space the way I did. One of David's mission was STS-43, and it was going to pass over Orlando at night at a certain point, like 4:30 in the morning. And so my wife, Lucia, she was like, "Oh, Pat, let's get up and go watch the shuttle." She was trying to encourage me or at least tolerate my interest in space. And so we take a couple of lawn chairs and we go out to Lake Eola. 4:30 in the morning, it's pitch black, and we set up our chairs, and there goes the shuttle. It looks like a small moving star going overhead. But unfortunately, there's a kind of critter in Central Florida known as a fire ant. And unfortunately, Lucia had placed her chair on a fire ant mound. Nobody got hurt, but she certainly felt some creepy crawlies, and we had to beat a quick a retreat. But we did get to see David Lowe and his crewmates going overhead inside Space Shuttle Atlantis.
Oh, I can't believe you actually have heard of him. It's, it was really interesting to find out the really super secret details that, like they wear diapers when they're sitting in the launch pad. A lot of people
sure.
know that. Yeah.
Well, actually, we have female astronauts to thank for that because, before, and I don't want to get too graphic, Jennifer, but before devices that they would use to allow astronauts to go to the bathroom, before they got out of their spacesuits were incredibly uncomfortable for the men because for the men, they would wear, frankly, what looked like kind of like a contraceptive with a tube on it. And it was really uncomfortable. And I wrote an article one time for the biggest news magazine in China. And they were launching the first female Chinese astronaut called a taikonaut. And so they said, "Hey, would you mind writing a story about women in space and stuff?" And one of the things that I found that because of the obvious anatomical differences between a male astronauts and female astronauts, they couldn't use the same kind of accommodation on female astronauts than they did on male astronauts. So that's when they started using the diapers because those work better for the ladies.
Funny.
Now the gentlemen are saying, whoa, wait a second, look at this. I mean, there's no discomfort. This is great. So they started advocating for the grampers too. And so all of a sudden, pretty soon, everybody on space missions were using the same thing. And we have the lady astronauts to thank for that. So I'm sure all the male astronauts are taking their hats or their helmets off or something for that.
I must have been the only person to ever ask David, like, what do you, like, do you have to just hold it when you're sitting? Because they're there for hours and hours.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm always like, where's the closest bathroom? No, so that was kind of funny. But his father was a very intimidating man and ended up founding the RPI Aerospace, called, like, the Center for Aerospace Studies. And he died of cancer a long time ago. But going to down the hallway to his office when my roommate was trying to get money, you know, we're in high school, and there were just mission, like all the different shuttles that he had worked on were in cases, glass cases. I mean, it was really cool. It was a very interesting time.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, there was another mission that he did one time that, before the Challenger accident, it was a payload of experiments that were left up in orbit called the Long Duration Exposure Facility. It was about the size of a school bus. And when Challenger blew up, they had to basically leave that experiment package stranded in space, and it was huge, and it was starting to fall into the atmosphere. So one of the first missions they sent after they resumed shuttle launches featured, you know, David Lowe. It was STS-32. And so, the one time when Lucia and I went out and we tried to find the one star moving high overhead, and that was the shuttle. Well, David's mission finding the long duration exposure facility was especially cool because you had the shuttle chasing an equally large object. So if you caught it at just the right time, and I did, it was like two stars, one chasing the other, moving across
that's
the horizon.
Really cool.
It was really cool, and they successfully brought it back, and everything worked out just great. So that's another feather in the cap for Mr. Lowe.
I love it. Well, I love it. I'm so thrilled that you knew who he was, and just it was such a neat little fun fact for me. And anyway, I don't want to take up any more of your time. It was just fun talking to you, and I'm just so happy you've heard of David Lowe.
Absolutely, it brought back a flood of memories and just very, very pleasant ones. And he obviously made some really great contributions. And it was a privilege for me to be able to cover that piece of American history that we're just never going to see again. And, your brother could probably, walk into a crowded room and people wouldn't know who he was because, at the time, the astronauts used to call it, their brand of fame, the kind of fame you put on and take off. Because if he's standing there in a nice business suit, no one would know him. But if he wore the blue flight coveralls with, embroidered space patches all over, everybody's like, oh, my gosh, it's an astronaut, and they want to get a picture with him and stuff. So, it's something that they just dealt with all the time.
Yeah. Well, I'll let you go, but I thank you for taking my call, Jennifer.
Well, you're quite welcome, Jennifer. Glad you could call in. Hey, and I learned something new about you. That's pretty fascinating. All right. You have
That's
a good
great, evening. Yeah.
Okay,
I will. Thank
All
you.
Right.
Okay, bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Well, that was an interesting surprise.
It was. Yeah, the fact that astronauts, if you ask kids, who's the first man to walk on the moon? They'll say, oh, Neil Armstrong. They'll say, who was the second man to walk on the moon? Like, oh, Buzz Aldrin. You say, who was the fifth? And all of a sudden the room just kind of goes silent because, being an astronaut used to make you really, really famous. I mean, when you were one of the Mercury ones, your picture was on Life magazine. Everybody knew your name, your wife's name, your dog's name. By the time you get to David Lowe, who flew in space several times and made significant contributions, I mean, no one, unfortunately, knows who these folks are, and it's a real shame. I mean, one time I was talking to, it was Mark Garneau. He's the Neil Armstrong of Canada, the very first Canadian to go into space. And I was interviewing him for NPR, and that's just radio, so you hear him but you don't see him. And he's standing there in a nice pair of slacks and a business shirt and a tie, and he looks really nice. And we're talking for a few minutes about his next flight, and then we wrap up. And then one of his one of the press people from NASA walks up to Mark and says, "Oh, Mark, CNN wants to talk to you on camera offside outside." I'm not kidding. He had a duffel bag with him. and he was like Superman running into the phone booth to change, because he ran into the first office he could find, slammed the door. 2 minutes later, he comes out in the bright blue flight suit with his NASA patches all over, and he's kind of like, "I'm ready for my close-up, Mr. DeMille," and they go outside and they do their CNN thing, and it gets back to that notion, you know, being an astronaut, it's fame you put on, and it's fame you take off.
Wow, no kidding. Well, you know, even Marilyn Monroe said she could be or not be her. She could just somehow not be noticed, or then turn to somebody and say, "Do you want to see me be her?" And something would come over, and then people would recognize her. But
yeah, I heard that.
A different way. Yeah, but
wow,
this
absolutely.
Is a whole different thing. It's like if you don't have the costume, the costume, which is a pretty big one, fairly unique one in this case, the coveralls and the space uniform. Yeah, I guess you're right. Yeah, because when you see, John Glenn or someone, Wally Schwab would be on magazines or on TV and stuff. But nowadays, yeah, you're right. We don't really know. We don't really see. So I can imagine him going and doing his phone booth Clark Kent.
Oh, sure. It's like one time, because once a year they'd have a family picnic at the Kennedy Space Center, and they would have a chili contest. And, I mean, the people there really – they take their chili seriously. I mean, they would have teams, and the teams would have T-shirts, and they would, they have secret recipes and all that sort of stuff. And they would have judges, and the judges would be a combination of either astronauts or people that NASA knew about. And a couple of times they ran out of celebrities, and they said, "Hey, Pat, would you mind coming being a chili judge?" And I'm kind of like, oh, that's fine. It's kind of like it's a reach out, community outreach kind of a thing. And so, one time I did it, and I sat down, and next to me sat Fred Hayes from Apollo 13. On the other side was Eileen Collins, the first woman to command a space shuttle mission. Mark Garneau, the guy that did the Superman change with CNN, and Bob Crippen, who was the commander of, he was the pilot of the first space shuttle mission and commanded the next three. And so, that was 1 year. The next year, they asked me to come back, and there was a gentleman sitting by himself under this tent. Nobody was paying attention to him. Nobody walked up to him. And I took a look closer, and it's like, oh, my God, that's astronaut John Young. I mean, he walked on the moon during Apollo 16, commanded the first launch of the space shuttle, and he's sitting there. Nobody knows who it is except me. So naturally, I went up and struck up a conversation with him. But he wasn't being mobbed by people. There weren't, autograph seekers or people, asking for selfies or anything like that. He was just kind of there by himself, waiting to taste the chili.
It's got to be times like this, when, first of all, being asked to be the honorary astronaut judge, and the moments like that, you've got to feel like you're just incredibly blessed. I would think that was like leading a magic life.
Well, you're obviously referring to – you're not referring to me, are you?
I am.
Oh, okay. Well, to be honest with you, it was a privilege. It was a great privilege to be able to to watch this stuff, because not everybody got to see a shuttle blast off, and I got to do it 103 times. And you literally, particularly at night, for example, when they would launch at night. Because you have the shuttle, up against the external fuel tank and the two booster rockets on either side, when the booster rockets would ignite, it's like daylight, instantly, and just and then when the rumble reaches you, you're about, for the press site is about 3 miles away from the launch pad, any closer and then the shockwave would kill you basically. So when the rumble actually reaches you, it almost burns into your breastbone. This rumble, and really when I'm doing the we do live coverage back then, I would have to lift my microphone up off the desk that I was working at, because the whole area would just be just rumbling as the shuttle would pull away. And to see that 103 times, and all that NASA accomplished during that time, the launch of the Hubble Space Telescope, I was there for that. As soon as they turned it on, it turned out that the thing was virtually blind. It couldn't see because NASA didn't have enough money to be able to test the main mirror on Hubble. So, okay, what are you going to do about that? Everybody's gunning for NASA's head and all that sort of stuff. So they say, okay, well, I'll tell you what we'll do. We can't go up and tinker with it. So what we're going to do is we just took a look at how blind or what blurry images they were able to get, and then they designed a small pickoff mirror the size of a nickel, and they put it inside one of the replacement boxes that astronauts could slide in and out of Hubble during a repair mission, and then they sent up astronauts in these heavy, you know, white pressure suits to float outside, and it's almost like, you know, these gloves are just so thick and bulky, and it's like, you know, handling your grandma's prized plates when you're walking around like this wearing boxing gloves.
Mm-hmm.
And so they had to do that and slide that box in and position that mirror exactly, otherwise a $1.5 billion telescope would just be a really big paperweight in orbit. NASA would look pretty stupid, and they did it. And being able to see stuff like that was just, you know, just pretty amazing.
Yeah, it was so awe-inspiring because it hasn't been seen before. You don't know who or when that will be seen again.
That's true.
That was one of those, what they call it, no do-over moment. That's it.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And there was one astronaut that worked on Hubble on a later mission, and he was realizing that every 12-year-old on Earth was kind of looking over his shoulder because Hubble was, like, more famous than the astronauts, because it would send down these beautiful pictures of stars and galaxies, and kids in classes would just be, you know, they would just be enthralled by it. And so Mike Fole, the astronaut, I was talking to him about a later repair mission. He was scared to death because they had to take out the main computer of Hubble and put in a new one. And again, he's wearing the big bulky white suit with the boxing gloves on. And he says, oh, Mike, and back, it's like, you know, if this doesn't work, every 12-year-old on Earth is just going to come gunning for him. And it worked out fine. But it was just, you know, the feats that they did. And then the last time they repaired Hubble, they actually rewired some of the electronics up wearing these heavy gloves. Like before, they would slide apart in, slide apart out. For the last mission, they literally rewired it, and it worked. And just, you know, it's just kind of like, can you top that, NASA? And they kind of go up and they do it. And it's just, it was certainly fun to cover. It was a good way to spend, you know, a total of like 22 years.
And magnificent. And I'm so glad that you've written at least two books so far. I hope you'll have more coming forward. So that, because you're giving us a bit of an, I don't know, like participant observer almost, or look at things. But let me ask you this first. Oh, but first of all, if you're listening live and you want to talk to Pat Duggins, call in 646-716-9922, which Blog Talk Radio assures me is a toll-free call in the continental U.S. So 646-716-9922. Although most of my listeners are in the U.S., the U.K., Australia, and some in Kazakhstan, where I don't know how I got over there, but although my husband works in satellite communications, I know a lot of the launches of satellites are done from Kazakhstan. So I don't know. Maybe that's it.
Not to interrupt, Jennifer, but yeah, most of the manned launches by the Russian space program are done from Kazakhstan. So it's like, you know, so hello to everybody over there on the steps of Kazakhstan, because a lot of what went on for the Russian space program was right there.
In Kazakhstan. Thanks for listening.
Oh, yeah.
And that's great. When so many other things I want to ask you about, and I know I don't have much time with you left, and you've been so generous already. But when you first started, there are always going to be some people, and you can just take whichever one of these questions you want to start with. Questions that I often hear, or sometimes people would hear, like, well, What good did it do? Somebody went to the moon, they walked on it, they walked outside of a space shuttle. You know, did it give us any kind of technological advances here? What did it do for us? Or the same thing with, you know, checking out Mars. And then there's also the matter of moving into what happened when private companies began to get the idea to start building rockets,
sure,
to go into space.
Let's
start anywhere. Go ahead.
Absolutely. Well, let's take those one at a time. As far as what we got out of NASA, there was one member of Congress. Mm-hmm. Now, admittedly, he was from Central Florida, which meant that, you know, Kennedy Space Center was in his backyard. But he always used to say that the greatest number of technological achievements in the United States occurred either when we went to space or when we went to war. So pick. And so basically, I mean, the number of technical advances, they're easier to spot back during the days of Project Apollo, because it's kind of like, you know, when Thomas Edison did his thing, needs were pretty obvious. I mean, we needed light at night. We needed to be able to, you know, to speak with people or you know, over great distances. So those were pretty obvious. One of the earliest advances, I guess, that everybody would probably be able to identify with, and it's a low-tech one, but just for the sake of conversation, would be WD-40. WD-40 actually, you know, people might use that on squeaky hinges or stuck doorknobs, but actually it was developed in California for use on Atlas rockets. Because when they launched these rockets, they were right next to the ocean, and because of that, you were getting a lot of salt spray, and there's a lot of corrosion on the outside of the rocket casings that could cause the rockets to fail. So this company started coming up with a water dispersion formula, because the humidity would get in the fuel lines of these rockets, and so they said, okay, why don't we come up with a chemical that makes the water go away? So they tried water dispersion formula number one, didn't work. They tried number two, didn't work. They tried 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. They went to 39. It didn't work. But finally, the water dispersion formula number 40, WD-40, actually was the one that worked. And that was all because of Atlas rockets. And then, you know, you've got other things such as, you know, like, you know, miniaturizing computers, delivering medicine to people in difficult places, water purification when you go up to the space station. I mean, you can't fly up water easily and cheaply. So what they did was they came up with a water purification system that's now being used in areas of third world countries that can't, you know, get water easily. And so what it does is, okay, here's another, it's going to get graphic here, Jennifer, I'm sorry, but what it does is it takes urine and it purifies it to the point that you can drink it. And so on the space station, they don't make any bones about it. They've literally got the bathroom next to the purifying system, next to the galley. So there's absolutely no, you know, mistaking A to B to C on how that system works. And it was perfected and used on the space station and is benefiting people here on Earth. So, you know, there are a lot of complaints about the cost of space travel, a lot of the dangers, not only for, you know, spacecraft that blow up, but I mean, like, they had astronauts go up there for like a year in orbit aboard the space station, and it did impact their physical systems, their bodies. So there's always people say there's pluses. There are always people that say that there are minuses, and it's just, you know, whether or not you choose to go. And up to this point, we've chosen to go, but, you know, democracies get to pick, and they get to make those choices. And I can go on to that second question too, but I don't want to blather on.
Okay, and what the second one was
about private companies. Absolutely. If you've ever been subjected to the movie 2001: A Space Odyssey, if anybody's dragged you to see it, and I've dragged Mrs. Duggins many a time to see it, you'll know that at the beginning of it, there's a space station run by Hilton, and a space shuttle that flies from Earth to orbit that was run by the now defunct Pan Am, but back in the day, Pan Am Airlines was like, you know, a big deal, you know, for flying from place to place.
Mm-hmm.
So even back in the mid-1960s, Arthur C. Clarke looked at the notion of, in low Earth orbit, we would have private companies making money doing this and that and this and that, and then sending astronauts off to far-flung places. That would be the role of the governmental space program. So we're sort of doing that now. There are, you know, with SpaceX and Orbital, I mean, they're launching, you know, commercial payloads, you know, for money. But now you've got Elon Musk, who owns SpaceX, even talking about the possibility of sending people onto the planet Mars. And so we started off with governments doing it back when it was us versus the Russians. But now we've got, you know, a couple of billionaires, Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos, that are talking about it. So then the debate could be, well, should a government could do this, should be doing this, or are we going to leave it up to a couple of billionaires with, you know, with a personal itch they want to scratch? Again, we'll just see how it turns out.
Any speculation on your part?
I think probably a combination of it would make more sense. See, the funny thing about it is, back in 1993, I was talking to Alan Shepard about this, and America's first man in space said, listen, forget going to Mars, forget going to the moon. If there's not an economic reason for us to do it, we're not going to do it. And his logic was inescapable, because it is just immensely expensive to send people, you know, it's literally like to orbit. Just orbit costs upwards of $3,000 a pound to be able to send stuff up. Now, with more routine flights by SpaceX, they may be able to drive that cost down a little bit, but it was almost like $100,000 a pound just to send something to the moon. You can imagine what it would cost to send something to Mars. And once you get there, the big question is kind of like, okay, we're here, why? And there are a lot of people like, oh, we're explorers and we should do exploring. And it's kind of like, well, that's fine. I mean, you know, that's basically what Columbus did. I mean, you know, he went to Queen Isabella and King Ferdinand, and he said, give me the money to go to the New World, and I will convert the natives to Christianity, and I will bring you back gold and precious stones and all that sort of stuff. Well, he gave the natives smallpox, and he brought back potatoes and tobacco. So if he had written that on his application for money to the Queen and the King of Spain, do you think he'd have gotten the money? I don't think so. So, you know, it's very expensive, and you just got to wonder what the payoff would be.
What about the space station? Well, I was going to ask you about the International Space Station, but tell me, what is the difference in different administrations in the White House and their attitude or tentativeness or support of the space program? Have you seen?
Well, it's interesting, yeah, because it has evolved. Because initially, President Kennedy wanted to use it kind of like as a great national achievement. Don't ask what you can do for your country. You know, ask what your country can do for you. What can you do for your country? Mm-hmm. And then he gave that great speech at Rice University. You know, we do this not because mm-hmm. it's easy, but because it's hard and all mm-hmm. that sort of stuff. And then you get along to like President Nixon, who basically was the one who pulled the plug on Apollo and said, okay, well, we're going to start building the space shuttle. And at the time, NASA was going to build both a space shuttle and a space station. But the Nixon administration said, whoa, wait a second, you get your hands off my checkbook, son. We can have one or the other. And since you had to be able to get to the station in order to do anything, they figured, okay, we'll build the shuttle first. And then, gosh, 1981 was the first launch of the shuttle. 1998 was the first launch of the space station. You had that big gap where the shuttle is basically just doing these little cutie pie missions, flying around, you know, in orbit, doing very, very little. And then when you brought in Bill Clinton, was the one who said, hey, why don't we turn the space program into a tool of diplomacy? And that's when we started working with the Russians. Now, if we hadn't worked with the Russians, arguably we couldn't have built the space station, because the Russians, when they realized there's no way that they were going to make it to the moon and have cosmonauts walking around on the moon, they decided to put all of their eggs in the basket of building space stations in Earth orbit. And by the time we started building the International Space Station, the Russians were really good at this. I mean, they'd launched a number of Salyut stations. We had docked the space shuttle to Mir. That's another space station that was built in 86. That, I can tell you, turned NASA on its head, because NASA had no idea how the Russians did business. Because, like, when NASA puts together a spacecraft or a space mission, they've got inspectors who inspect the inspectors who inspect the inspectors, and they piles and piles of paperwork and stuff. And so when NASA first found out, okay, the president wants us to collaborate with the Russians on a bunch of missions to dock our shuttle to their space station Mir, we had to fly over to Moscow and see how they did stuff. And they'd walk into these warehouses where the space gear for Russia was being built, and you'd have parts laying everywhere. You'd have puddles of oil on the floor. You'd have no documentation. The Russians' attitude was kind of like, oh, time for the launch. Click, click, click. Here's your hardware. Go. And NASA freaked. They couldn't believe that they were actually doing that. But the Russian stuff worked. And so I'm speaking from my office. And my wife, bless her heart, when I finally earned my master's degree about 6 months ago, she took the 11 mission press badges from all of those missions with Russia, where NASA teamed up with Russia, and I covered it and framed them. It's hanging up in my office right now. It completely turned NASA on its head as far as how to do things in space, but they wouldn't have been able to build the space station had they not learned those lessons from Russia.
Amazing. It is interesting how just the different attitudes and how things are made, or the different procedures or maybe lack of procedures. They're like that. Spaceflight Now tweeted today, SpaceX plans to roll out the first Falcon Heavy rocket to its launch pad in Florida next month. But the company says liftoff of the world's most powerful launcher will not occur until early next year. Tell us about this, what you know about the SpaceX Falcon Heavy.
Oh, sure, absolutely. Well, the regular Falcon rocket can carry up, like, satellites and carry cargo, and there's a small capsule called Dragon that currently delivers cargo to the International Space Station. Now, when Elon Musk first trotted out his Falcon rocket and his Dragon capsule, the first thing that I kind of noticed was, okay, this thing is built to carry cargo. Why does it have a porthole? And so I kind of ran that past NASA, and it's kind of like, the last time I looked, I've never seen cargo having to look out a window, okay? So you knew even back then Elon Musk had his sights set on manned spaceflight. And so with the Falcon Heavy, he would be able to launch they're building a manned version of the capsule, which is a little bit, you know, it's a little dicier than just launching cargo, because with the cargo, it's a one-way trip, and it just goes up. So if your capsule falls into the atmosphere and burns up, well, that's not a really big deal. But if you happen to have astronauts in there with families who want to see them at the end of their flight, you know, you've got to be able to have the safety systems to make it work. So that's something that he needs to iron out. There's also a rocket actually being designed here in Alabama, where I am, that NASA is building. It's called the Space Launch System, or the SLS, and it will be bigger than the Saturn V that sent men to the moon, and if it works, and they're hoping that it works, it will send astronauts out of Earth orbit to go someplace else for the first time since 1972, and that's kind of the next big leap in terms of, like, do we go to the moon, do we go to Mars? That new rocket that NASA is working on here in Alabama, that's the key to whatever, you know, NASA's ambitions might be.
Was the last Bush administration, 43, wasn't George W. Bush, President George W. Bush, did he have a focus on Mars or an interest in getting to Mars?
Not that he talked about a lot. The one thing that he did was he came up with something called Project Constellation. And what that was it was kind of like, okay, the space shuttle, if you look at the vehicle, it had this big cavernous cargo bay right in back of the crew capsule where the astronauts all would sit. And you could put things in there like the Hubble Space Telescope or the long-duration exposure facility that George Low chased and retrieved, you know, on his flight. But once the space station was built, there really wasn't a need for a spacecraft that big that could carry up big pieces of cargo, because there was no cargo to carry up. So what Bush the Younger had in mind was something called Project Constellation, which a lot of people were kind of like, meh, we didn't think it was a really great idea, because what he wanted to do was take one of the solid rocket boosters that would launch the shuttle and put a manned Orion capsule on top of that one booster and blast that into space. And that's, you know, that's what he wanted to do. Now, everybody at NASA got the heebie-jeebies over that, because the booster rockets for the space shuttle use something called solid fuel. In other words, it's not liquid like the gas you put in your car. It looks like the fuel inside the booster rocket looks like a giant pencil eraser, basically. And the thing about it is, once it ignites, it doesn't unignite. You can't stop it. So once it launches, you're going to fly in one piece or several for several minutes, and there's nothing really you can do about it. So they were kind of worried about whether or not they would be able to control that vehicle if there was some kind of a problem. They couldn't shut it down. What do you do with the astronauts that are still on top in their capsule? So that whole thing kind of like went away when the Obama administration came in, and that's when we just went ahead in 2011 to just, you know, finish the space shuttle program. All those space shuttles are now in museums, and then we started paying like $100 million each for a seat for one of our astronauts to go up on Russian Soyuz vehicles. Don't tell me that didn't rankle Congress, but that's what we did, basically, until we come up with our own ability to send people up, whether it's Elon Musk's Dragon capsule, Boeing is working on one, the Starliner, which is kind of it almost looks like an Apollo capsule, and they would put those on top of Atlas V rockets, again, built here in Alabama, and they would launch human beings on that. But we're just waiting for that next American ability to get into space.
From the information that's been brought back, just or studies of Mars, do we at any point, do we see that there could be a way for people to survive on Mars? I mean, I know this wouldn't be just some little simple trip to go up there for a few. I mean, if you're going, you'd have to be gone for, what, 6 months to get there? Or
six months to get there, and then you'd have to wait a year for Earth and Mars to realign, and then another 6 months to go back. It's funny you mentioned that. One of the most fun parts of Trailblazing Mars was there was an astronaut who, unless I'm mistaken, made more spacewalks at the time during the shuttle program than anybody else. His name was Jerry Ross. He was an Air Force colonel, really nice guy, and he was big into genealogy. And he and I got talking one time, and he had mentioned that he had traced his family tree back to a fellow named Daniel Dillabaugh, who was a Canadian, who after the Civil War wanted to go and mine silver in the Wind River Mountains of Wyoming. And I kind of looked at the life that Daniel Dillabaugh was leading there with 19th century technology and what people on Mars would face with 21st century technology, and the parallels were just so striking I included it in the book because, you know, where he was, where Daniel Dillabaugh was in, you know, the 1860s in Wyoming, up in those mountains, you couldn't grow your own food because it was too cold. There wasn't enough material to be able to build a house or a barn because the trees wouldn't grow. If you injured yourself, it literally was like 2 weeks on horseback to the nearest railroad depot. You literally had to survive by your wits and what you brought with you. And that's kind of what people going to Mars are going to face. There's no water that we know of on Mars, so you're going to have to figure that out. It's extremely cold, extremely arid. There's no magnetic field around Mars, kind of like Earth, so you've got constant bombardment of cosmic rays. It's a nasty place to live, it really is. And so what they're trying to do is figure out ways to keep people alive on a planet where you don't really have all that much in terms of natural resources. And I don't know if you've seen demonstrations of something called a 3D printer.
Yeah.
Okay. They're thinking of sending 3D printers to Mars and scooping up Mars soil, and with that being able to literally manufacture, you know, bricks for a house, bricks for a landing pad, tools. Anything that you might need, you might be able to make out of, you know, Mars soil that way. But it's kind of like, you know, back when Shackelford, you know, did his I hope I get this story right. He either went to the North Pole or the South Pole. But the point of it is there wasn't a whole lot to do or to eat there. So instead of bringing, you know, a whole big old, you know, ship full of Pop-Tarts or whatever like that, he brought tools and he brought nails and he bought bullets. And with that, he was able to live off the land when he was doing his exploration. And if a Mars trip is going to have to work, that's what NASA is going to have to do. They're going to have to figure out how to live off the planet where there's not a lot of resources to be had.
So think about the 3D printer. Yeah, I think you're talking about Ernest Shackleton.
Yes. If I got his name wrong, I apologize to his descendants and all.
And I apologize as well, just because I happen to be in the room. I don't want to seem complicit in anything. When you talk about the space odyssey, you know, I, as I said, from an early age, I was such a big science fiction fan, and even after seeing the movie, I always wanted to, still want to have a kitchen one day where when I go in to turn the coffee on, it just comes up and says, the kitchen is operational and fully functional. I want to hear Hal's voice tell me that. But anyway,
well, I can tell you one thing.
At least I'll take the bad part of the end, okay?
Oh, not at all, not at all. No, actually, when they filmed that movie, they went to Sweden, I think it was, and they got the guys on the spaceship with Hal. What are you doing, Dave? Those guys. Uh-huh. They had, back in 1968, the most futuristic flatware they could find was, I think, from Sweden, and they still sell it to this day. And one of these days, I'm going to talk Mrs. Duggins into letting us get it, because even, you know, 1968, what, it's like 50 years later, it's like it's still just the coolest stuff in the world. And that was in the galley where they messed around with Hal the Computer on 2001. I thought it was great anyway.
Well, let me ask you this before you go. Oh, and by the way, folks, if you're listening, you know, you can get Pat Duggan's books, Trailblazing Mars, NASA's Next Giant Leap, and Final Countdown, NASA and the End of the Space Shuttle Program on Amazon, or at your favorite booksellers. If it's not there, ask them to order it. And or you can listen to him on Alabama Public Radio. And so before I go, you know, I've got to ask you this. And first of all, thank you so much for being here with me, Pat. And for,
oh, Jennifer, it was an absolute pleasure. It was an absolute pleasure.
You were delighted. And for being so generous with your time here, information, I have thoroughly enjoyed this. But let me ask you this. If you had the opportunity to go into space, would you go and where would you want to go?
Okay, to be honest with you, Mrs. Duggins has to put a knife to my back to get me on the log flume ride at Disney World. So the notion of actually going is kind of like Zippo, because it's like, you know, I was talking to Norman Thagard one time, who's the first astronaut to work aboard the Russian space station Mir, and he said, you know what we do for a living is we kind of strap ourselves to a bomb and we blow ourselves into orbit. And he said, you know, there really has to be some degree of emotional immaturity there to do that. And, you know, his logic was inescapable. So would I go? If somebody offered, yeah, I probably would. But there would be a very serious talk around the dinner table before I could definitely sign on the dotted line. Although I have gone on the vomit comet. That was interesting, where you float around.
All right, put your foot down.
No moon at all. What a night.
Hey.
Okay.
Even lightning, but
no moon at all. All right, well, thank you so much. I do hope you'll come back to Madame Perry's salon soon.
I thoroughly enjoyed it. Thank you so much, Jennifer.
And thank you. Good night.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Even Spider was afraid to bark. What a perfect chance to